Radio 4 News.
Jonathan Freeland will be taking the long view in half an hour, but first it's time for the last in the series of Case Notes with Dr. Mark Porter.
Hello. There are around 1.5 million people with diabetes in the UK, and probably nearly as many again, who have the condition but don't know it. And the situation looks set to get much worse, with some experts predicting a global epidemic that could see rates of diabetes double over the next 30 years. Nearly all of that increase will be in type 2 diabetes, the more common variety that typically affects middle-aged, overweight people, although it's becoming an increasing problem in much younger people, and the type that we'll be concentrating on in this programme. I'll be discovering how body shape influences your odds of developing diabetes and how exercise can protect against it.
The most extreme example in nature is the sumo wrestler, who might weigh 30 stones or 200 kilos, but their exercise regime is so intense, they carry very little fat actually inside the abdomen. That vast girth of the sumo wrestler is actually subcutaneous fat.
I'll be finding out why chef Anthony Worrell Thompson, not known for worrying too much about his figure, is, rather uncharacteristically, now following his doctor's orders to the letter.
As with most guys who've got a very busy life, I said to myself, I haven't got time. And the doctor said, well, you certainly won't have time at the end of your life because it would be a lot shortened if you don't do something about it. So he said, you've got to find time.
My guest today is Lorraine Avery. She's a consultant nurse in diabetes at St Richard's Hospital in Chichester, and she joins us from our studio in Southampton. Lorraine, I've already mentioned that there are two types of diabetes. What's the difference?
Diabetes is a condition where the pancreas doesn't produce, either in type 1 diabetes, doesn't produce any insulin, or in type 2 diabetes, where it just doesn't produce enough.
And of course, insulin is the hormone that controls sugar levels. So presumably the net result is much the same. If you don't produce enough insulin, or you don't produce any insulin at all, your sugar levels climb. Why is that a worry?
Well, very often when I talk to patients about the problem with high blood sugar levels is that I ask them to imagine that their circulation is actually running like syrup. And obviously, if you have a syrupy circulation, it can affect all of your blood vessels and lead to long-term complications of diabetes.
What about the short term? How might people know that they've got a problem?
Well, very classically, diabetes presents with symptoms. People can feel very tired, very thirsty. They might pass lots of urine. Unfortunately, some patients actually don't have any symptoms whatsoever. And that's because particularly type 2 diabetes can present very slowly. And as the blood sugar levels climb very slowly, then these symptoms may not be evident. And that's why we end up with a number of people who don't actually know that they've got it.
And how do we diagnose it? If someone comes to you, to me, a GP, and says, you know, I think I might have diabetes, what's the definitive way to diagnose the condition?
Well, diabetes is actually very simply diagnosed with a blood test. I always remind patients that normal blood sugar levels are between 3.5 and 7.5. And we can do one of two blood tests. We can either ask the patient to present to the surgery having not eaten, a fasting blood sugar level, we call that. Mm-hmm. And that really shouldn't be any higher than 7. Or if they have eaten and we decide to do the blood test opportunistically, then we wouldn't expect that to be any higher than 11.
And how high can sugar levels go in a bad case of diabetes?
Well, gosh, in my experience, I've known somebody who presented with a blood sugar level of 78, and they were clearly very unwell. But I suppose the average presentation, if there was such a thing, would be somewhere late teens, early 20s, particularly in type 2 diabetes.
Well, Claire Mehmet was 46 when she spotted a Diabetes UK poster listing some of those familiar-sounding symptoms.
I saw a poster in the station, and it said, are you always going to the toilet? Are you always thirsty? And is your eyesight changing? And I said to my friend, that's you. She said, no, it's you. I went to be tested and it was me.
And these symptoms have been going on for how long altogether now, looking back?
Looking back, about 10 years before I was diagnosed.
And how quickly did they resolve once you were put on treatment?
I can say that I felt much better within 3 months.
Claire Mehmet, who was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes back in 1994. Lorraine, that's not an unusual story. You were saying that there's an awful lot of people out there who've got the condition who don't know that they've got it. Why is that a problem?
Well, I think very often the pancreas stops producing insulin on a very slow basis, so the sugar level climbs very slowly, and therefore the body just takes this extra bit of glucose on board, and the blood sugar levels can get to very high levels and start doing the damage. So sometimes when people first present with diabetes, we can already see signs that the diabetes has been doing damage to their blood vessels.
So they might not have, the symptoms might not be that severe, but they're putting themselves at risk of long-term damage. And what sort of things are we worried about in the long term? What are the main problems?
Heart attacks, strokes, damage to the eyes, damage to the kidneys. And the outlook for both types of diabetes can be equally frightening. But the main worry with type 2 diabetes is that a number of people possibly ignore those very early symptoms or really don't get them so severe that would worry them enough to go to the doctor. And I think the other thing is that people don't always go, because I think people are worried about going to the doctor saying, oh, I feel a bit tired, I feel a bit thirsty, you know, particularly if it's been summer and that, you know, the symptoms could easily be attributed to something else.
What's causing the diabetes and who's most at risk?
Well, I think the largest causative factor of type 2 diabetes is the rising obesity that we're seeing. And I think it's so underestimated, the link between type 2 diabetes and obesity. The larger you are, you're far more likely to develop type 2 diabetes. That, if you've got a family history, you're allowing yourself to become overweight, you're becoming less and less active. If you start to add up all of these risk factors, you could almost tick all the boxes and put your fate in front of you.
Are there any ethnic variations?
Asian people are far more likely to get diabetes. So if they have a family history, you're Asian, you're overweight, again, that's three major risk factors ticked.
Well, Terry Wilkin is Professor of Endocrinology and Metabolism at the Peninsula Medical School in Plymouth, and I asked him to explain why there is such a strong link between being overweight and the risk of developing diabetes.
The basic abnormalities of obesity and their relationship are still being worked on very hard. It's a major research area. But the fundamental change is that we become resistant to our own insulin, and the body is built in such a way that if we become resistant to insulin on account of body weight increase, then we make more insulin. That's a natural response to try and overcome the resistance, but of course it can't go on forever. And we reach a time where we have now gained so much body weight, become so insulin resistant, that the cells that make the insulin can't work any harder, and there is a loss of control of the blood glucose, and when that goes up, then by definition we have diabetes.
Does it matter where we store that fat? I mean, there's a lot of research looking at the link between diabetes and intra-abdominal fat, people who are apple-shaped rather than pear-shaped.
Yeah. Now, it's crucial. And this is a very fundamental observation that was made some 60 years ago now by a Professor Varg in Marseille, who first described les pommes and les poires as the apples and the pears, because he realized that those who are apple-shaped, although they might carry the same weight as somebody else who was pear-shaped, were nevertheless at much greater risk of diabetes and heart disease and hypertension and stroke and so on.
But why is that? What's the difference between fat that's sitting inside your tummy and fat that's sitting on your hips on the bottom?
It literally is sitting inside your tummy, and that is the difference, because the fat that is around your middle is sitting inside the abdominal cavity, around the digestive organs, and anything that gets absorbed from within the abdominal cavity goes straight to the liver. Whereas anything that gets absorbed from fat that's under the skin goes into the what we call the systemic or main circulation. Now, the importance about these products going to the liver from inside the abdomen is that the liver is a major site of glucose control. And this fat that's inside the abdomen isn't simply an inert stock of unneeded calories. It's in fact very active, and it produces a number of what we call adipokines, which are molecules that cause insulin resistance when they get to the liver. So it's very important where you store your fat. And if you happen to be overweight but pear-shaped, then that's pretty harmless metabolically. But if you're overweight and apple-shaped, then you're, I'm afraid, in trouble.
What about losing weight? If somebody has diabetes and is overweight, one of the first things we do is encourage them to lose weight. Is there any different approach depending on whether your fat is intra-abdominal, whether it's on your hips and bottom?
Well, if you reverse the balance that caused the weight gain in the first place, then you will lose the weight in the places that you've put it on. But there is other and perhaps more subtle approaches to this, because we know that physical activity in itself, irrespective of how much weight you lose, physical activity will drive fat out of the abdominal cavity. And that's probably one of the ways in which it's most helpful.
Might this be one of the ways in which physical activity seems to protect against things like heart disease and diabetes?
I'm quite sure it's very important, and the most extreme example in nature is the sumo wrestler, who might weigh 30 stones or 200 kilos, But their exercise regime is so intense, they carry very little fat actually inside the abdomen. That vast girth of the sumo wrestler is actually subcutaneous fat. And they are relatively insulin sensitive until they retire, and then, unhappily, seldom will they pass 50, because all that fat will get redistributed back into the abdomen, and then the problems of insulin resistance and diabetes and so forth ensue.
Now, obesity is a huge problem in British adults, but perhaps it's even more of a problem in the next generation that are coming through. What should we be doing about this?
Well, I think it's a very under-researched area, because we spent a lot of time, perhaps 10 or 20 years, looking quite carefully and intensely at the adult, but we're one of the very few studies around the world, the early bird study in the Southwest, that is looking at children and asking the question, what is it about children that produces insulin resistance? And I think we are gaining evidence that physical activity is an important component, but it's not something that necessarily is something you can modify in a child. Diet may be more important than we think. I think what we have got is a group of young children nowadays who are seriously overweight. I mean, something like 25 to 30% of five-year-old girls are now overweight. And that is a legacy for the future that we really have to do something about, or we will be in major, major trouble.
Professor Terry Wilking. To put that risk into perspective, obese people are 25 to 30 times more likely to develop diabetes. And if you want to know whether you're laying fat down inside your abdomen, then just measure your waist. Ideally, women's waist should be less than 32 inches. Over 35 inches and the risk to health start to become substantial. Men's waists should be under 37 inches, with the risks increasing dramatically once they're over 40 inches. You're listening to Case Notes. I'm Dr. Mark Porter, and I'm discussing diabetes with my guest, Lorraine Avery. Lorraine, can we treat diabetes simply through weight loss?
I think it has to be one of the first focuses for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. I guess my concern sometimes is people that have been overweight for a very long time struggle with that as the focus. And I think we have to be very clear that there are enormous benefits from losing weight and, as you've just highlighted in terms of waist measurement, changing shape. We really do need to focus on changing eating habits, ones that are going to be maintained and sustained to achieve the ultimate in terms of losing weight.
Have you actually had patients who've not needed any other treatment because they've managed to lose 2 or 3 stone and their diabetes has, in inverted commas, gone away?
Well, as we know, diabetes never actually goes away. But, yeah, we do have some success stories. And I think it's when we've actually been able to make that very clear association with, if you lose weight, then the likelihood of you needing any further treatment for your diabetes in the short-term future is much greater. I think it's inevitable, though, and it's something we ought to point out to people with diabetes, that they are always going to need tablets. We do know it's a progressive disorder. Very few people survive long-term just watching what they eat, and tablets being the next form of treatment.
And that was going to be my next question. What sort of treatment will most people with type 2 diabetes need? We used to treat people with diet alone, but from what you just said, we don't tend to do that anymore, do we?
Only for a short period. We tend to treat type 2 diabetes far more aggressively than we might have done in the past. And that's partly because we recognise it's progressive in nature and people do need pills. And there are a number of different tablets that we use to treat diabetes. There are some that stimulate the pancreas to produce more insulin, some that reduce the amount of sugar produced by the liver, and some that actually improve insulin sensitivity. These are relatively new on the market. But very often people will need a combination of these tablets ultimately to improve their blood glucose levels.
Of course, as with type 1 diabetes, the aim is to control the levels as tightly as possible, to get them, to normalise them, if you like. If we don't treat the sugar levels, they go too high. We know that that damages the blood vessels and stroke and heart attack, etc. But overdoing it can be even more dangerous in the short term, can't it?
Absolutely right. If we do over-treat people with diabetes, there are one particular tablet or group of tablets, the tablets that stimulate the pancreas to produce insulin. Obviously, somebody takes these and then they don't eat. You can actually lead to blood sugar levels being too low, which will lead to symptoms such as the heart pounding, very shaky, very sweaty, people lose their colour. And obviously, you then need to treat that with glucose or something sugary to bring the blood sugar levels back up. So we have to get the balance right in terms of people watching what they eat and the right formulation of the tablets that they take.
Of course, that attack being hypoglycemic attack, or what's commonly known as a hypo.
Absolutely.
Well, Chef Anthony Worrell Thompson is now a shadow of his former self, thanks to a rigorous diet and exercise programme prompted by discovering, while being tested on a TV programme, that he had metabolic syndrome, also known as Syndrome X, a collection of factors including obesity, diabetes and high blood pressure, which, if untreated, dramatically increase the risk of an early stroke or heart attack. Fortunately, his problems were spotted before he developed full-blown diabetes, as Connie St. Louis discovered.
As with most guys who've got a very busy life, I said to myself, I haven't got time. And the doctor said, well, you certainly won't have time at the end of your life because it would be a lot shortened if you don't do something about it. So he said, you've got to find time. It is a matter of willpower, but it is also saying to yourself, you've got a life-threatening disease. You can't just treat it lightly. You've got to actually treat it really seriously and do something about it. And I've managed to get rid of my Syndrome X. If I hadn't had that revealed in a TV program, I probably would have gone on to be diabetic, and then I would have had far greater problems. They tell me to lose 2.5 stone. I've lost 1.5 stone so far. So what do I do in the future? Well, I'm still going to carry on doing the exercise. Hopefully I'll get fit enough to say I can do it under my own steam without paying a fortune to a personal trainer. I shall certainly carry on walking the dogs at a brisk pace, and I shall think very hard about what I eat.
One of the keys to successful control and prevention of diabetes is to eat foods that have a low GI or glycemic index. The GI index diet has become a regular feature of health and beauty magazines, but it's more than just a trendy way to lose weight. It's central to leading a healthy diabetic lifestyle. Dietitian Asmina Govinji.
GI refers to the way a food acts in your blood once you've eaten it, and it refers to carbohydrate foods. Certain carbohydrate foods will be digested quickly because of the way that their fiber is or because of the components within that carbohydrate. If they're digested quickly, they cause a very sharp, fast rise in blood glucose and a very sharp fall. This is considered to be unhealthy because you're actually getting peaks and troughs and swings in blood glucose, certainly not what you want to be doing in diabetes. If you choose low GI foods such as pasta, grains, fruit and veg, nuts, whole grain cereals, then your food is digested more slowly, which means that your blood sugar goes up more slowly. And this slow, steady rise in blood sugar is far more valuable in terms of general health, diabetes, obesity, Syndrome X, than having lots of high GI foods.
How am I going to recognise them, or do I just need to learn what is a good low GI food?
One of the leading supermarkets has already started labelling foods with lower medium GI logos. So that's going to be a great step forward for people with diabetes to at a glance know that this particular type of pasta or bread or beans are lower in GI than this other product here. There are also several books on the market, and if you look at a book with reputable, credible authors, then you will get a good idea of which foods are better and which foods to base your meals on.
One of Anthony's responses to his initial need for more information was to write a cookery book entitled Healthy Eating for Diabetes. All eating regimes should have their treats, if you're going to stick to them. But the GI index posed a challenge for Anthony in trying to create his favourite recipe, the chocolate sponge.
It was coming up with a pudding that diabetics could eat, because that's one of the hardest areas. Lots of fruit puddings, of course, you can eat and things like that, and the custard seems to be okay with most diabetics.
What have you done to that that makes it more suitable for diabetics to eat?
Well, it's the reduction in sugar. But generally using a normal sponge recipe, but keeping it much lighter. So it was obviously cutting out the fats. I did a pudding that would serve 8 to 10 people, and I think it uses 5 or 6 teaspoons of sugar, which when you divide it between the 8 or 10, was within the boundaries that they recommend for diabetes type 2.
Anthony Worrell-Thompson talking to Connie St. Louis. Lorraine, we heard there how Anthony managed to act in time. Type 2 diabetes is largely preventable.
Well, I think if you know you have a family history, which increases your risk of about 30% of type 2 diabetes, if you can stop yourself becoming overweight and keeping yourself as active as possible, then both of these will actually limit or reduce your risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
And how strong a family history do you need? I mean, you say the risk is increased by around a third if you have someone in your family. Does it have to be a parent, or what about a grandparent?
parent, grandparent. It tends to be familial rather than hereditary, so it doesn't necessarily sort of follow every single generation. But the larger the family history, then the larger risk of developing type 2 diabetes particularly.
What about the age at which people are developing type 2 diabetes? When I was at medical school, I was taught that traditionally this is something that happened to people, you know, in their 50s or 60s. But we are seeing people develop it at an earlier age now. Is that simply a reflection of the fact that we're getting heavier as a nation?
Absolutely. I mean, as Terry Wilkin pointed out, that the number of people or the children that are developing obesity at a much younger age, I think that's one factor, but also the fact children are lazier, whereas you and I would have gone down to the park to play on bikes and swings and things and kept ourselves very active playing footy or whatever. Children of today sit and play Game Boys, computer games, and are less likely to do more activity that we would have done. And I think it's possibly reduced in schools as well.
Thank you for now, Lorraine. Well, we've already heard that ethnic background can affect your chance of getting diabetes. People who are from Asian backgrounds are more likely to develop the condition. But it's not just your ethnicity that can influence your risk of developing diabetes. Religious and cultural beliefs can also impact on how the condition is managed. Veronica Green is a diabetes specialist nurse at the Cromwell Hospital in London.
Most hospital setups are set up to have white Caucasian people, white Caucasian diets and meat and two veg and those sorts of things, and not necessarily set up to have people of different cultures. And so they're not used to the different diets, they're not used to different healthcare beliefs, and they're not necessarily used to different religions and different religious practices that people may have.
So how does that impact on diabetic control?
There are certain religious connotations around food, for example. So, for example, in some Muslim societies, dates are highly prized and people will eat an awful lot of dates, but one date is equal to one spoonful of sugar. So if you eat 10 dates, the impact on someone's blood sugar is enormous. If you're a Hindu, for example, they have something called Kara Prashad, which is made out of glucose, semolina and butter. So again, when they go to temple and they're given this, if you eat all of it, it can put someone's blood sugar up to 20 millimoles very, very easily. So it can make them very high, very thirsty, very symptomatic. And so if the healthcare professional is not aware of these different practices, then they can't advise someone to look after their diabetes and how to react to these different situations and so help them control their blood sugar.
Well, let's take those types of foodstuffs first. What advice would you give to people who need to eat those or want to eat those sorts of things?
Is moderation. There's very, very few things in diabetes that we say you mustn't eat ever. So things like dates, for example, we'd say to have maybe one or two dates a day, but try and spread them out over the day. If you're a Hindu or a Sikh and you go to temple, then by all means take all of the Kara Prashad that you're given, but only have a little bit and spread the rest around amongst your family so you're spreading the blessings associated with that food.
Samia Basgar is a case in point. She's a Muslim, but because of her diabetes, finds it impossible to observe the traditional fast from sunrise to sunset during the holy month of Ramadan. I asked her what happens when she tries, her daughter Helai interprets. What happens when you fast during Ramadan?
She feels really weak. She can't fast. She feels really dizzy. She gets really sick sometimes. So it's kind of impossible to fast in Ramadan. And sometimes she has to break it as well.
How important is it for you to try and fast?
She gets really upset when she can't fast because Ramadan is one of the pillars in Islam, and she wants to do it, you know. It's like a compulsory thing. She wants to do it, but she can't.
In that circumstance, what you need to do, what if someone was on tablets, for instance, I would look at what medication they were on and maybe change the doses slightly so that if they had two tablets in the morning and one tablet in the evening, I would swap those doses around.
Because the risk being, obviously, that if they have their treatment, their insulin or their tablets,
their
and they're not eating, that their blood sugar will go too low, and that's potentially very dangerous.
Yes, I also insist that people test. They have to test their blood sugar far more often when they're fasting than they would do normally.
Do you think doctors in Britain are aware enough of the cultural and religious implications of either a condition or its treatment?
I don't think so. I think that people see a condition, that you have diabetes, but they don't necessarily see the person behind that condition who may be extremely religious of whatever sort of religion, not just Hindus or Muslims. I've had someone who was a Christian and was going hypo on every Sunday, and it took me ages to figure out what was going on.
Well, I'm just sitting here now, and I've got a couple of Muslim families that I look after, and three members of which are diabetic, and I actually haven't considered fasting or anything at all. And they've not discussed it with me either.
Well, sometimes they won't discuss it because they think, well, you're going to tell me not to do it. And so they don't want necessarily to discuss it. They don't want the news that you're going to tell them not to do it. Whereas if they say, well, look, I want to fast, how can I do it safely? Then that's a much nicer approach. And now what I tend to do is ask them, are you going to fast? So I'm the person that's bridging that gap. And that helps.
What about the sort of food that you eat? Has the diagnosis made any difference for the sort of food that you eat yourself or prepare for your family?
Her diet is completely different to us because she prepared food for us as well and for herself. So that makes it really hard for her because she has to make like only kind of food for us, and then she has to suffer eating fish and, you know.
Suffer.
Yeah.
She's eating a healthier diet.
Yeah, but she doesn't want to, you know. She wants to at least have once in a week proper food, like with her family, but she can't have it because of her diet. Especially when our birthdays and some special occasions like Eid is one of the main things. She can't have any sweets or anything like that.
Sounds like you take your diet very seriously, which not all my patients do, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, because we make her as well to have proper diet, you know, because when she's having something bad, she gets really ill, and we don't want her to get ill.
Samir and Helai Bazga. Lorraine, diabetes now accounts for something like a 20th of the total NHS budget. Who in the modern NHS should be looking after most people with diabetes?
Well, I think firstly, obviously, the main responsibility is the person themselves. I mean, there are a number of things that they can do in terms of maintaining their ideal body weight, exercising and stopping smoking. But because we have such a large number of people with type 2 diabetes, the majority of people with type 2 diabetes will be cared for in their local doctor's surgery in general practice, where they should be receiving what we call an annual review, where their overall diabetes control is assessed, their blood pressure's checked, their cholesterol's checked, kidney function and their eyes tested, and their feet examined. All of those things should be happening at least on an annual basis. And that could be done either by a doctor or a nurse, either healthcare professional. Both will be able to do that.
And the outlook for most people with well-managed type 2 diabetes, we've mentioned a lot about risk factors and you know how the increased risk of stroke and heart disease, but we can moderate those significantly, can't we?
Absolutely, and I think that's something that we have to bear in mind, that the outlook is far more positive. We do have the research to support that if we look after all of these factors, then the outlook for type 2 diabetes is much better now than it would have been if I'd been sat here 10, 15 years ago.
Lorraine Avery, thank you very much. That's all we have time for. We spent much of the programme discussing obesity and how diet and exercise can help both prevent and treat the most common form of diabetes. So, with that in mind, look out for this week's Fat Nation, The Big Challenge, which continues on BBC One this Thursday at 8 p.m. It may just prove the inspiration you need. Check out the website bbc.co.uk/fatnation. And talking of websites, do visit ours, bbc.co.uk/radio4, if you want any more information on diabetes or if you'd like to listen to the programme again. This is the last programme in the current series, but we'll be back later in the year.
Case Notes was presented by Dr. Mark Porter, and the producer was Helen Sharp. And if you have a question arising from today's programme, you can call the Radio 4 Action Line on 0800 044 044.
For sheer consistency, delight and surprise, it's really got to be I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue.
I like the way Phylon 4 gets a subject between its teeth and just gnaws it and shakes it and worries it.
Woman's Hour. I think it is an extraordinary mix of fantastic information and then very obscure facts about the body.
I need news.
Shipping forecast.
Oh, the Archers, definitely.
Veg Talk.
Today programme for being able to get up that early.
What more does a man want in life than sailing by?
To me, the epitome of a wonderful afternoon is sitting in a lounger chair listening to the afternoon play.
Desert Island Discs. As soon as I hear that theme music, you think, yes, all is well with the world.
And that's coming back soon. This is BBC Radio 4. Now The Long View with Jonathan Friedland.
The Troubles have gone on for decades, one part of the United Kingdom riven by a violent campaign to break out of the Union. London needs to bring peace to this troublesome province and to get the paramilitaries to decommission their weapons. That could be today's Northern Ireland, where a new round of pivotal talks at Leeds Castle are due to start on Thursday. But it was also the story of 18th century Scotland, which is why we've come here to Leith. We're on the quayside here, overlooking the Firth of Forth. It's a fine day, the water looking perfectly clear and blue. That's the scene here now, but alongside me, Professor of History at Aberdeen University, Alan McInnes. What would this have looked like back then in the 18th century?
Well, this is the place where the government had its main bases for watching the whole of the East Coast. The Royal Navy would be based here because of the Troubles. It would have ships.